This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
All right. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, hello. Welcome to Whitworth University. We are so happy that you all came out tonight. I'm August Weil. I serve Whitworth University as a groundskeeper, and we are delighted to have Dr. Ingham here this evening. We've been reading a lot of her stuff over the past couple years as we've been dreaming about starting to compost, and actually this spring we actually started using compost tea on all of the campus, and so we are excited to have her. We spent today with her, and she knows what she's talking about, and I'm telling you what, it was one of the best days we've had here as a facilities, I can say that. Some of the best meetings we've had. And so we are so excited. So join me in welcoming Dr. Elaine Ingham.
Thank you. So I very specifically said, don't go through the dull, boring, everything I've done in my life, how many publications. There it is on the board. And now we're going to go on to the more exciting stuff. So those of you who do want to get hold of me, there's the email address. So I may take a few days to get back to you. I get about 200 emails a day. And sometimes I don't quite get all of them answered. So, you know, be patient. If I don't respond back to you in like 3 to 7 days, send the email again. Because sometimes it gets lost. So the website is soilfoodweb.com. And so a lot of information on the website, so use that as a resource as well. So going on, the soil food web, all the organisms that we really need to understand in the soil, because without all of these organisms, it's not soil. And that's one of the points of understanding that many soils people in the past have not fully comprehended. The attitude has been, well, these organisms, they just come back. Right, okay, so after we've totally nuked all the life in the soil by using toxic chemicals, by using things that are basically sterilants, why would the organisms come back? Because what's there? What's left for them? And they don't just immediately find their way back into the system, especially when you think about some of our agricultural systems. How many miles away is the closest source of these microorganisms? Because the microorganisms aren't coming in from the next agricultural field because those organisms have already been destroyed. So where are they going to be coming back in from? And the further away that source of the organisms are, the longer it's going to take for the organisms to get back into that soil. So who are your taxi cabs to get those organisms back into the soil? Well, it's going to have to be you and me at this point because we've done such a wonderful job of destroying that life in our soils. So understanding what each of these organism groups do and being able to assess your own soil and take a look at what's missing in your soil. If I want to grow this kind of plant, I have to have the full food web in the proper balance. So tonight I'd like to briefly go over who are all these organisms that you need to know and understand? Who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? A little bit about how you would identify whether they're present in your soil or not. And then some examples of people who have been doing this work and been highly successful. There's a lot of people that are out there that will say, oh, I tried the compost tea stuff. I tried that compost and it doesn't work. Well, I can almost guarantee you that they did not get compost. They went out to the local municipality composting yard where that material is black, stinky, smelly, and putrid. What would lead you to believe that you've got good life in that stinky, smelly stuff? If it's black, it's not compost. Compost is aerobic. By definition, compost is the aerobic decomposition of a mix of organic matter. What do we mean aerobic? With air, with oxygen. And so you've got to be turning that pile. If it gets too hot, you have to turn the pile to put the organisms back to drop the temperature. So there's a whole composting class that you might want to come to. We have online courses at this point, so you can take those courses from any place on the planet that you want to. You don't have to come to Oregon to hear me. So decomposition, what do we mean decomposition? Well, it means we've got to have this food web present in your compost, because it is the bacteria and the fungi that make the enzymes to start to break down that organic material. Bacteria and fungi are going to take up all those nutrients and store them in their bodies. And that's where they're going to stay, unless you have the rest of the food web. There has to be predators to eat the bacteria and fungi and release those nutrients that have been stored in the bacteria and fungi, and they release those nutrients in a plant-available form. So exactly why is that? I can go into those details. I will try to get to those details tonight, but I'm not promising you. I've only got an hour to try to fill your minds with 3 days' worth of information on just the life in the soil and what it does and who they are. And then there's a whole course on compost, and there's a whole course on compost tea and compost extract, and then there's a whole course on doing the identifications of these organisms yourself. I would love to have all of you get a $350 microscope and start doing your own assessments of your own biology. Okay, you don't want to do it, so get the guy sitting next to you to do it. So hopefully here at Whitworth, we are going to have people doing that. So could we make this a hub of learning how to do all of this biological approach and do the conversions and do some of the testing and see what really works in this part of the world? Because remember, you've got a unique environment here. There is no place else on this planet exactly like the situation here. And that means you need the indigenous organisms to do the work for you. We need to have the locally adapted sets of bacteria and fungi, protozoa, nematodes, microarthropods, mycorrhizal fungi, earthworms, spiders, voles, shrews. It has to be the indigenous sets of organisms. So you cannot buy compost from California and bring it up here and expect that those organisms are going to be happy about being translocated here. They are used to it being hot and dry. Yeah, what kind of environment are we looking at right here, right now? Nothing like California. This does not happen in that part of the world. So, dry summers, yeah, but we've got to have those organisms that can deal with the cooler, wetter parts of the year that we do have here. So, unique climates, we have to have the indigenous organisms. So I want to go into understanding who these organisms are and who's important. Let's, of course, start with plants. Sunlight and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, through the process of photosynthesis, are going to make sugars. Well, the plant can't grow on sugar alone. The plant really only gets two things from above ground. Everything else has to come through the soil. It has to come through the root system. So sunlight and carbon dioxide, that's all we need from above ground. See, so really, above ground's not very important, because all the other nutrients have to come through the roots. Well, maybe a tiny bit can come through foliar feeding, but it's insignificant compared to what your plant requires. So think of all the nutrients that have to be made available to your plant in the root zone. And of course, your plant is going to take the sugars that are made through photosynthesis and pump them down into the root system, and those sugars are going to be the carriers of the nitrogen and the phosphorus and the sulfur, the magnesium, the calcium, the sodium, the iron, the zinc, the boron, all of those nutrients that your plant has to have in order to grow. I love it. When I was a kid, how many essential nutrients were there for plants? Three. Yeah, right. You're going to grow on NPK. Yeah, those are all the essential nutrients they are. By the time I get into high school, how many essential nutrients were there? Well, we'd added a few things. We recognized that sulfur is really important, that calcium and iron. So there were 8 essential nutrients. By the time I got into graduate school, it was 21. Today, most plant physiologists that are right up there on the cutting edge are going to be saying, how many essential nutrients? It's the answer to the universe. 42. So, in that list of essential elements, do they include arsenic? Is arsenic an essential nutrient for your body? If you had no arsenic in your body, what would happen to you? Your nerves don't function. You would just be a pile of protoplasm on the floor. Not going to be able to move around. So is arsenic an essential nutrient? Yes. How much arsenic do you need? Not much. But you got to have enough, but not too much. So every single nutrient has to be in the proper concentration. Who controls or what controls the uptake of all of those nutrients into the plant? Well, arsenic, where do you find arsenic? Where does that exist in your soil? It comes from the rocks. It comes from the pebbles. It comes from the sand, the silt, and the clay. Where does sand, silt, and clay come from? Comes from your bedrock, from your rocks, from your boulders. So you're just looking at the breakdown of the existing rock formation. The bedrock in this part of the country is going to determine what your composition, what the fraction of sand, silt, and clay. So as that breaks down, we better have the bacteria and the fungi present in your soil because they make the enzymes to pull those not soluble, not plant available forms of nutrients, and it pulls them and inside the bodies of the bacteria and fungi. I'm sorry, they are not available to your plant. So we're storing nutrients. You want to keep the nutrients in your soil when you've got rain that's fallen like we were having today, as we have very wet times, when your snow melts in the springtime. If you've got soluble nutrients in your soil, where are those soluble nutrients going? Bye. They're not in your soil. They're certainly probably not in the root zone. Certainly not in the root zone in a conventional agricultural system. So we want to be holding those nutrients, keeping them, and that's why we really need the bacteria and fungi growing in that soil. When we look at that winter time period, is there any activity going on in your soil in the middle of the winter time? Absolutely. The most rapid rates of decomposition occur in the winter under the snow. More rapid decomposition in the winter under the snow than a tropical rainforest. Got to have the indigenous local organisms that like those cold temperatures. But as long as you've got free water, and you always have that in the interface between snow and the surface of your soil, so that thin layer at the surface of the soil is where your bacteria and fungi are going gangbusters. They are having a grand old time decomposing all that litter material, all those residues that came down to the surface of the soil, and happily turning it into bacterial and fungal biomass, tying up your nutrients, keeping them. When that snow melts, no loss of nutrients, if you've got the biology in your soil. What if you didn't have the biology? Yeah, say goodbye to any soluble nutrients. So the tire uppers of nutrients within your soil. We then have to have all of these organisms. So protozoa, the two groups of aerobic protozoa, the amoebae and the flagellates. Soil has to be aerobic. Your roots cannot live in an anaerobic environment. And so we have the aerobic flagellates and amoebae, and they eat the bacteria. Because the C-to-N ratio of the bacteria is so much narrower on all of the nutrients, not just nitrogen, but phosphorus, sulfur, magnesium, calcium, sodium, potassium, all however many of the nutrients in the periodic table that your plants require is going to be released in a plant-available form when the predators of bacteria, so here's bacterial feeding nematodes, some of the good guy nematodes, when they eat bacteria, we are releasing nutrients in a plant-available form. And all of them balanced properly for your plant to take up. Not just a massive concentration of nitrogen. So when we put out inorganic fertilizers, do we put out all of the nutrients that your plant's going to need? We overload the system with phosphate fertilizer, or we overload it with nitrate, or we overload it with calcium. If you're putting lime and gypsum out there, understand what you're doing. We'll go into that in a little bit. So we're releasing nutrients in a plant available form when our fungi are eaten by fungal feeding nematodes or fungal feeding microarthropods. Any of these interactions, we're going to release nutrients in a plant available form. But those available nutrients have to be right around the root system of the plant, don't they? If our plant and its root system is right here, do we want lots of these kinds of predator-prey interactions in our soils to be happening over here? Not if it's bare soil. Because if there's no roots over here to take up those plant available nutrients, the next time it's going to rain, where are those nutrients going? So we want all of this activity concentrated in the root zone. So how did Mother Nature figure out how to make certain that all of this interaction, all of the really important stuff is happening right in the root zone of your plant? Well, who's putting out the foods to feed the bacteria and fungi? It's the plant. Plants produce exudates below ground, and the plant is going to make certain that it's putting out the exudates to grow the specific bacteria and fungi that it needs to supply, very particularly, the mix of nutrients that it requires. What's an exudate? Yeah, it's a wonderful scientific term. What does it mean? Exudate, something that is exuded from the body. So when you sneeze, achoo! Yep, that's exudate. Yummy stuff. So your plant is putting out exudates. What is that exactly? It's exuded, but what is it? Exudates are made up of mostly sugar. So where's your plant getting sugar from? Photosynthesis. Here we go. So some of those sugars go out. Some of that exudate is protein, and some of that exudate is carbohydrate. So if I sent you into your kitchen, and I asked you to make a recipe of mostly sugar, a little bit of protein, and a little bit of carbohydrate, what am I asking you to make? Cakes and cookies. Your plant is dumping cakes and cookies out into the soil. So see, I can confuse you wonderfully using scientific ease. Or I can just say it's cakes and cookies. So your plant is putting out cakes and cookies to feed the right kinds of bacteria to make the enzymes to rip those nutrients from the sand, the silt, the clay, the rocks, the pebbles, and, well, if we've got organic matter, yeah, from the organic matter. Organic matter, does it contain the nutrients your plant needs to grow? Yeah, it's what the plant's made of. So how could it not be the right stuff? So if you've got organic matter in your soil, these bacteria and fungi are going to be able to grow happily all the time if you've got adequate organic matter in your soil. Well, you better replenish that organic matter, and so ultimately we got to get back to the plants. So we've got cakes and cookies coming out of the root system to grow the bacteria and fungi to do the job of pulling the not plant available nutrients out of your soil, out of the inorganic, from the rocks and pebbles and everything else. And so they're going to be tying up those nutrients in their bodies. So, of course, they are concentrated around that root system. So there is a castle wall that your plant is building around its root systems in order to have those nutrients appear in precisely the forms that your plant requires once the microarthropods, the nematodes, the good guy nematodes, and the protozoa are attracted into that root zone because of the massive number of bacteria and fungi growing around those roots. So here come the predators releasing those nutrients in plant-available forms, and usually way more than the plant actually requires. So what happens to all of those good soluble nutrients right around that root system that the plant doesn't need to take up? Does that leach out of the root zone? No. Because anything not eaten by the protozoa and the nematodes and the microarthropods is going to suck up those plant-available nutrients. If the plant doesn't take them up, that next layer of bacteria and fungi fed by the plant is going to take up those soluble nutrients, retain it, and hold it in their bodies. So one of the really important functions of the soil is to make certain that we have this biology doing the nutrient cycling. There is no soil on this planet that lacks the nutrients to grow plants. What are you doing putting inorganic fertilizers out there? Why should we have to put organic fertilizers out there? Because if we have the proper biology, There is absolutely no reason to be putting fertilizer out at all. Think of the chemical companies that are saying, oh my God, we're going to run out of phosphate fertilizer. We've got to go out and we've got to find the technology. We got to develop this somehow. You've got to send us billions of dollars so we can figure out how to make phosphate fertilizer so we can continue growing plants for the rest of forever. Excuse me? What a load of silliness. Because your soil already contains all of those nutrients. So I'm going to go forward because I think, come on, go forward. There we go. Nutrients, mineral nutrients, these are the total nutrients that are present in your soil. We're looking at the range of all of these different kinds of nutrients, and believe me, this keeps going on for a couple pages. So all nutrients, is, you know, I just figured you would get the idea if I showed you this page. So every introductory soils book, every textbook has this list of the concentration of the mineral nutrients in your soil. Not plant available. You've got to have the bacterium fungi use their enzymes to pull this out of your sands, your silts, your clays, your rocks, your pebbles, and your organic matter. But if we're looking at just the rocks, the average value summed over all soils on this planet. Is there any soil on this planet for which any one of these values is zero? There is no soil on this planet that lacks the nutrients to grow plants. We just lack the biology to move the nutrients out of these inorganic, not plant available, not soluble forms of nutrients and move it into a plant available form. So when a fertilizer company tells you that you're lacking in phosphate or you're lacking in calcium or you're lacking in iron, they're not telling you truth about your soil because those nutrients are already in your soil. They're neglecting to tell you that what is preventing these nutrients from becoming plant available is the lack of biology in your soil. So you want to go on giving money to people who are lying to you? Or do you want to start converting what's in your soil by putting the biology back into your soil? So where are you going to get this biology to put it back into your soil? It's called compost. Make your own compost. So when we're getting that mix of organic matter, the starting materials to go into your compost pile, where are the organisms coming from that are going into that compost pile? It's on the plant material. Is there any plant on this planet that lacks biology on its surfaces? Well, if you've put on 2,4-D, if you put on a whole bunch of Roundup, if you put out the pesticides, if you've put out massive concentrations of inorganic fertilizers, you have destroyed the biology. Maybe not all of it, but probably what's left are the disease causers, the pathogens. And so you really don't want to be growing a whole bunch of pathogens in your compost. You want to grow the beneficials. So go out and get that plant material that has not been treated with those toxic chemicals. We need to start calling those materials precisely what they are. They are toxic chemicals. Every single inorganic fertilizer is a salt. Every single one is taking water away from your microorganisms. If we took you and we dumped you into a vat of table salt, just one of the many kinds of salts, if we dropped you into a vat of salt, what's going to happen to you? Just think of giant sucking sounds. All the water in your body is sucked out and is now held by the salt, and you're going to turn into a giant prune and die. So when we put out more than 100 pounds of any inorganic fertilizer into our soil, we are going to be killing the very microorganisms that we need to do this nutrient cycling process. We are making ourselves dependent on things we don't need. Who's making money? Not you. The chemical company is. So do we have to get this information out to everyone who grows plants that we're falling into a mental trap? when we start believing what those toxic chemical purveyors are telling us. Every single soil, there is no soil on this planet that lacks the nutrients to grow your plants. Now, a lot of times people will look like, oh, that's not a lot of molybdenum. Well, how much molybdenum does your plant require on an annual basis? This is parts per million. Your plant needs parts per billion. There is more than adequate amount of everything already in your soil. You go out and you start putting more on, and then you go and out and put on some more inorganic fertilizer or even organic fertilizers, and you go out and put on some more, and then you're going to go and put more on. What should we call you? Moron farmer. So, you know, we need to learn this lesson and communicate it to everybody that we don't need to be doing that. So I don't care what introductory soil science textbook you go to, you will find a table like this. These are the total, not plant available. And we got to convert it into the plant available forms of those nutrients. I'm going to back up. So when we're thinking about this set of organisms, it's not just nutrient cycling. It's not just providing nutrients to your plant. Remember, we're talking about cakes and cookies coming out of those root systems? Well, how about above ground? Are there cakes and cookies coming out above ground? Absolutely. Every surface of the plant is releasing cakes and cookies. And it's different kinds of cakes and cookies depending on what the plant needs. So really, who's in control of growing these bacteria and fungi? It's your plant. Let your plant be in control of its own life. Why do we think we know better? How many of you have talked to your plant and managed to put out the nutrients precisely at the right time and the right concentrations for the best growth of that plant? Yeah, make yourself giggle. We don't do such a good job, do we? So let the plant be in control of its own requirements. So it's putting out the cakes and cookies everywhere. It's growing massive numbers of bacteria and fungi around the root system on every surface above ground. So all the leaves, all the stems, all the flowers, all of your seeds, all of the fruit should be covered in a layer of these beneficial organisms. When you eat that fruit and you take a bite out of that apple, you need the organisms on the surface of that apple to run your digestive system. Where are we going to get the organisms to supply what we require? How long has this symbiotic interaction been happening? And it's only in the last, 20, 25 years where the USDA has been trying to convince us that soil, that surfaces of everything we eat should be sterile? Who's benefiting from that point of view? Why are people so sick? Why do we have to put amendments? We've got to go to the store and we've got to buy this amendment and that amendment and this other amendment so that we can be healthy. If you've got to buy pills to make you healthy, there's something very wrong. We don't have the biology on the surfaces of that plant material that we're consuming. Oh, we got to make sure that they're good guy. Bacteria and fungi, protozoa and nematodes. We've got to make certain that it's the good organisms that are there. And that means we've got to have the healthy sets of organisms in the soil. So everything is going to be coated with the good guys and not the bad guys. So what's the really important factor? What's something that we haven't really recognized? It's that soil has to be aerobic. If we go anaerobic, we're going to be growing the pests. We're going to be growing the diseases. 95% of all our disease-causing organisms require reduced oxygen conditions in order to be able to out-compete the good guys. And so your plant's putting out those exudates. It better have good oxygen around that root system or the roots are going to die. Roots cannot tolerate the anaerobic compounds that are made under anaerobic conditions. If we go anaerobic, we're going to be converting all of our soluble, plant-available nitrogen into ammonia. What does ammonia do to your plant? Kills it. And we're going to be taking all of our sulfur, the sulfate, all the soluble inorganic sulfur compounds that your plant needs to be able to grow, and we're converting that sulfate into hydrogen sulfide. What's that smell? Phew, rotten eggs. And what does that hydrogen sulfide do to your plant? Kills it. It's an extremely acidic compound. We're going to take all of our phosphate under anaerobic conditions. That's going to be converted into phosphine gas. Do not breathe that stuff. It will kill you in one breath. So what does it do to the root systems of your plants? Kills them. Under anaerobic conditions, we make really strong acids. And so the pH of your soil, your pH of anything, is going to start plummeting towards the very low numbers. If we get all the organic acids, anaerobic organic acids, being produced by these anaerobic organisms growing in anaerobic conditions, we're going to drop the pH of our soil to 2. How many of your plants grow in a soil of a pH of 2? Because that solubilizes organic matter and turns it into mush. Only under anaerobic conditions do we produce the most plant toxic material known to man, which is alcohol. Only under anaerobic conditions do we produce alcohol. So if we allow our soils to go anaerobic, that alcohol is, once again, going to solubilize all of our plant materials and turn it into mush. Good luck growing a plant. Why won't your roots grow into a compacted soil? Because it's anaerobic. And we just went through all of the things that will kill your plant if you allow your soil to become compacted. If you allow the anaerobic materials to grow, anaerobic organisms to grow, that's what they're going to do. And that's then no longer soil, is it? What would you call putrid, anaerobic, stinky, smelly, black stuff? Dirt? Sludge? Yeah, apply all of the above, but it's not going to grow plants. So see where we have to make certain that we're building structure within our soil. When you look at these organisms right around that root zone, concentrated, growing to really high numbers, one of their functions is to build structure. Bacteria make a lot of glues. Aerobic bacteria make alkaline glues, and they're going to glue together a lot of the microaggregates. We're starting to build structure. Instead of little tiny bits and pieces of clay and sand and silt, really difficult for oxygen to move there when we've just got things completely dispersed, no structure built, really hard to move oxygen or water, or good luck getting your roots to grow through that. So we have to have the bacteria starting to glue microaggregates together. As microaggregates are built, then the fungi come along and they use their filamentous hyphae to pull those microaggregates together into macroaggregates, ever increasing our ability to move oxygen and water and the roots deeper and deeper into our soil. How far down into the soil should the roots of your tomatoes go? And we have this bizarre idea that most of the roots of our plants are confined to the top couple of inches. No way, Jose. This is an artifact of the damage that we've done to our soils. And yet, there it is in most of the textbooks. Roots don't grow very far down into the soil, maximum 6 inches. Oh, great. Know how far down the roots of my tomatoes go? 10 feet. Do I have to water my tomatoes in the summertime? No. No reason. So we go to lots of places all over the world. We grow oases in the desert in Saudi Arabia, around various places in the Mideast, in Jordan. We've done this over and over again, working with Jeff Lawton, for example. We go to Australia, where they're in the middle, I think they're in their 40th year of drought in Australia. Yeah, the 40th year of drought. What would you really call that? Climate change, you think? Maybe 40 years of not getting historically normal amounts of rain. And yet we are growing table grapes in that part of the world because we're getting the root systems of the grapevines to go down 25 feet. How far down can the roots of your trees go? That varies from species to species. But minimum, the root systems of your tree should go as deep into the soil as you've got foliage above ground. Where did we get the idea that the root systems of our trees only go down maybe 2-3 feet and then go sideways? Compaction layers. We impose the compaction on that soil through the methods, the management we applied before we planted those trees. Now we're forcing those plants, those trees, to grow in coffins. So why do the trees get sick? Why are they unhealthy? Why do the trees not grow and remain healthy as long as they ought to? Because of the damage we've done, because we've converted our soil into dirt. How are you going to fix that problem? How are we going to rebuild structure so those roots can go as deep into the soil as they should be going? We've got to get the biology back in here. We've got to get the bacteria to build the microaggregates, the fungi to build the macroaggregates, the larger critters to make the large pore spaces so we can have swimming pools and rivers and lakes and streams in our soil. We need mini aquifers that your roots can get to in the summertime. All of our soil, all of our water, and that snow melts in the springtime. All of that water needs to be stored in your soil, and you cannot store it if you have no structure. We've got to have organic matter down there. We've got to hold all that water, but you can't hold it if you don't have any structure. No structure, compaction, that water goes to the compaction layer, and it's going to go downhill, and it causes erosion, and most of your soil or dirt is going to end up in your lakes and rivers and streams and ultimately into the ocean. So how critical is it to get all of this life back into the soil? So here we have our good guy bacteria and fungi. Make sure it's aerobic. That's why we got to have structure. Get oxygen down there so it maintains the beneficial and not the bad guys. We got to have the predators in the system. Well, but you know, if you get too many of these guys, they're going to overeat those guys. And if you don't have enough bacteria and fungi, then your plant's not going to get the nutrients it needs, and the whole system's going to collapse, and we're right back where we started. So how do we keep there from being too many of these guys? Well, that's those guys. We have to have the higher level predators. We've got to have the predatory nematodes. We've got to have the predatory microarthropods to keep these guys in balance with those guys. Well, what happens if you get too many of these guys? And they start overeating these guys. All your nutrients are going to end up in your bacteria and fungi, and your plants are going to be dead. Because all the nutrients are tied up in the bacteria and fungi, and there's no way to make those plants available anymore. So how do you make certain that you don't get too many of these guys? Bingo. Just get, who's at the top of the food web? Us. It's our job to make sure that we maintain the life in the soil so things function the way they ought to. We're not really good at understanding and knowing the second-by-second interactions that have to happen in here. So we want to make certain that the balance of these organisms stays within certain ranges. And if we're starting to lose some of these organisms, we put them back. And so where do you get these organisms to put back into your soil? It's called, all together now, compost, yes. So what are the easiest ways of putting compost out into your soil? And really, it's not so much that we're putting compost out, it's that we're putting the organisms. How do you get those organisms out there? Well, solid compost, that can be a little spendy to go spread it out on large acreages. So maybe in large areas, you want to convert that compost into a liquid form. So we're going to extract the organisms and the soluble foods out of that compost, extract it, and now we've got a compost extract. And so now we can apply that to the soil. What if we've got to fix problems above ground? What if we've got to get the biology to stick to the above-ground part of the plant because you've got insect pests above ground, so you've got aphids, you've got white flies, you've got virus, you've got various kinds of problems. You've got all those annoying insects that eat your fruit before you can get to it. So we have to get this biology on our above-ground part of the plant. Well, you know, you spread a solid compost on the top part of your plant, not much of it sticks. So what do you have to do to get this biology to stick to those plant surfaces? We've got to make a compost tea. It's only the actively growing, very rapidly growing microorganisms that make the glues so that when we spray them out on those plant surfaces, they instantly stick to those plant surfaces. What's the most important part of the leaf to get covered? Above? Underneath. Underneath. Because guess where the diseases always start? Down here. Where do your insect pests lay their eggs? So we've got to get these organisms that they will stick to the underside of the leaf, which means we have to make sure they're growing very rapidly. They're making the glues so they stick to those surfaces. So we have to make a compost tea. We're going to take our compost, extract the organisms and the soluble foods out of that compost, but now we're going to add additional foods to get those organisms growing really rapidly. Do you make a compost tea at the highest temperature you possibly can? Well, high temperature, the organisms grow faster. Yeah, but if you're going to be out there spraying your trees right now to start fixing some of the problems, you're growing these organisms at 85 degrees and you're now going to take an organism happy doing its thing at 85 degrees and you're going to go put it out to in 55? If I took you off the beach in Waikiki in Hawaii, and I dumped you outside and said, do your job. How many of you would? Sorry, you're going to have to do it in your bikini. Not happening, is it? You're hunkering down and you're going like, oh, please let me back inside. You're not going to do a job out there. You are going to go dormant as rapidly as possible, escape into an environment. So don't be doing that to your microorganisms. You grow the compost tea organisms at the temperature you're going to put those organisms into. So there's no shock. There's no organisms going to sleep, and then the ones you do need take a day or two or three to wake up and start growing. You make the tea at the temperature you're putting it. If I made my compost tea outside right now, but I'm now going to apply it in my greenhouse that's still at 70, 80 degrees. No, don't do that, because you're not going to see any benefit. We do have to get the organisms on those leaf surfaces and start protecting. So protection against diseases is another really critical part of what these microorganisms will do for you. We want to make certain that some of the fungi that we're getting back into the system are the mycorrhizal fungi, not this, the decomposer fungi. So don't get confused and think that mycorrhizal fungi are the only fungi I'm talking about. There's a whole herd of decomposer fungi, highly beneficial, that are going to outcompete your diseases and your pests and your root-feeding nematodes. So we've got to have both. Mycorrhizal fungi colonizing the root system, so mycorrhizal fungi, colonizing the root systems of the plants that require mycorrhizal fungi are critically important in protecting against disease and going out and collecting nutrients and bringing them back to the plant in exchange for sugars from your plant. So all of these organisms, the whole food web, we've got to understand these organisms, what they're doing. You need to be able to look at your soil and find out what's not there, what's missing. And then you make sure that you're making a compost that has the missing organisms and you put that back into the system. So let's make sure. Yeah, there we go. We had the list of benefits. So in written form, suppressing disease, competition, inhibition. I do want to point out here that we're not talking nuke it approach here. We're not talking wiping out all of the bad guys. We want kind of a background number of these, you know, very low level, but we want them to be still around so we maintain the immune system. This is not a toxic chemical approach. These are not biocontrol agents that are going to go forth and wipe out all of something else. We're putting back into the system the organisms that are required and needed. So let's put back what should be present. Let's not call these biocontrol agents. We are not using a nukem approach. We're retaining nutrients, so that's our bacteria and fungi. And, of course, if you retain all your nutrients, you stop having these problems. We're then going to have the organisms that make the nutrients available at the rates the plant requires, when the plant requires it, because who's in control of nutrient cycling in your soil? We got to decompose any toxins. So if there are anaerobic microsites, we've got to be able to get rid of those. And again, that's your bacteria and fungi. We need the full diversity, maximum diversity. Because think about the fact that our bacteria and fungi are very strongly selected by temperature. Every time you shift temperature by maybe 2 to 5 degrees, these organisms, the ones that are growing at 55 degrees, are going to go to sleep. And a whole different set of microorganisms wake up and they start growing at 60 degrees. As the temperature shifts a little bit more, those organisms go to sleep and the next set of microorganisms go to sleep. And so how many temperatures are going to happen in your soil over the course of the next year? And you need microorganisms to grow at each of those temperatures. What's the moisture regime going to be in your soil as you grow over the next couple of years? Lots of different temperatures, lots of different moistures, lots of different chemical. So we've got to maximize diversity in our compost piles. How do we maximize diversity in your compost pile? Put lots of different kinds of plant materials into your compost pile. We need the maximum diversity of different plant materials with their associated organisms going into the compost pile. So when the different temperatures and moistures and nutrient concentrations are present, we grow the appropriate organisms. And then building structure. Talked about that already, so those are the things we've got to be aware of. When you look at a soil chemistry report, what is the information on a soil chemistry report that you're getting? Please realize that that last picture where we're talking about the total nutrient pool, the blue box here, the total. You are not told one thing, absolutely no information about the total nutrients actually present in your soil. Nothing about that on your soil chemistry reports. You're told about 4 of the forms of nutrients that are in this exchangeable pool, your base saturation. So exchangeable calcium, exchangeable magnesium, exchangeable potassium, and sodium. Think you might need to know about more than just that. And then, of course, here's the soluble nutrients. And most of what you're told about on your soil chemistry report is this little teeny tiny pool. Less than 1% of all the nutrients that are present in your soil. Can I scare the living daylights out of you by telling you about just the soluble pool? Oh my God, you're not going to be able to grow your peas. You don't have enough nutrients in here, so you got to get fertilizers. So hopefully now you can defend yourself against that and not get stuck in with that particular piece of insanity. You know what that soil chemistry report's actually telling you, hopefully. So the different nutrient pools, just quick went over that. So how do you know when there is a real problem in your soil? That you really have to go back in there and put some more biology to get this nutrient cycling going. Maybe you would want to look at plant tissue concentrations. Now take some of your plant materials, send that into the laboratory, and find out what really is lacking in your plant. Because I can show you soil chemistry reports that say, there's plenty of phosphate in your soil. The soluble inorganic phosphorus is just fine. You look in your plant tissue, and there is no phosphorus in your plant. And that's why it's sick, and that's why it's unhealthy, and that's why it can't resist disease or pests. And I can show you the opposite, where the phosphate level in that soil is so low that any agronomist would go ballistic. You can't possibly grow plants in here. I love it when I do this. Go out to your old growth forest. Grab some of the soil. Send it into your soil chemistry lab and watch your agronomist go crazy. Because the nutrient concentrations of almost everything in that very productive soil from that old growth forest is extremely low. Because your plants don't really need massive quantities on a day-by-day basis. They just need that pool replenished every second of every day through their whole life cycle, through the whole entire year. And so I can drive agronomists crazy because they'll say, oh my gosh, you can't possibly grow plants. And then I look at them and I say, So explain to me why that's an old-growth forest. Are we growing plants? Yeah. Not an agricultural field. Well, let's make our agricultural soil start looking like that old-growth forest. There are more nutrients stored in the trees, in the vegetation, in that old-growth forest than we are removing from our agricultural fields and carting off and selling. There's more nutrients removed in an old-growth forest on an annual basis than any agricultural field you want to talk about. How does that forest manage to keep growing? The highest productivity of any ecosystem on this planet is old-growth forests. So where do those nutrients come from? And can't we tap the same set of nutrients in our agricultural fields? Until the day you run out of sand, silt, clay, rocks, or pebbles in your soil, you should not be putting any more nutrients back in your soil. How many of you don't have rocks? So see, fertilizers, pointless. You do have to get the biology back in your soil. So let's keep going. So when we're looking at soils, if you want to put this in a slightly different way, you know, think about in a true soil where we've got the organisms. We've got the sands, the silts, the clays. Water moving through that soil gives you clean water. All those nutrients are tailed and stored in the soil. We're not going to have any toxic materials leaching. We're not going to have any nutrients. Whereas if you're dealing with dirt that doesn't have the biology, we're going to end up with compaction, and now nutrients, your water, totally dirty, so totally undrinkable, chock full of things that will not be healthy for anything downstream, are going to leave through erosion, through runoff. If water moves through here, completely undrinkable. Monsanto says we're going to run out of food to feed the world in 2025. Are we going to actually get there at the rate at which we're destroying water quality? We have more than enough food to feed everybody on this planet, a good, healthy diet. We are not lacking food. We lack the will to get that food to the people who need it and are starving to death. But that's a political problem. That's human will problem. We do not lack food to feed everybody on this planet, but what are we running out of right now? Clean water. We don't have enough clean water, and there are people dying because of that. So we have to get the biology back in the soil to overcome this problem, fix these problems. So let's go through some pictures of critters just to make sure that you all know what these critters look like. So you can get your own microscope and you can start identifying whether you've got these organisms in your soil or not. So here's a lamus. Isn't she cute? Look at that nematode. There she is. There's her mouth. And by looking at the mouth structure, I can tell you that this is a bacterial feeder. On a daily basis, she's going to be eating thousands of bacteria and releasing all the nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, magnesium, calcium, sodium, potassium, making it available to your plant. So we want to see a good 100 of these nematodes per gram of our soil, per teaspoon of our soil, so that we can set up that nutrient cycling to keep your plant healthy. So it's not stressed, it's not unhappy. So how many of you can identify who this critter is in this soil? Well, we've got lots of bacteria. You can see all these little dots in here. And if I go back one, oops, just one, thank you. There's lots of aggregates, so you know, if I focused on these, there's a lot of bacteria. You can see some of the bacteria sitting on the surface of that nematode. In here, we've got lots of bacteria. There's an aggregate. Ooh, look at the color of that aggregate. What causes that nice, rich, dark, 70% cocoa color? This is the decomposition of the organic matter by the bacteria and fungi. And they're making these storage forms of organic material in your soil. So we know in the past, we've had some really good activity because we've got some really good humic acid. Humus is being built. We've got aggregates being made. But now, this is my root. Roots should be uniform diameter as you go along. And so as you're looking here, you can see, yep, it's pretty uniform diameter. You can see lots of the cells inside that root. But we reach right here and you go, whoa, that's not uniform diameter. Somebody took a bite out of my root. I've got a root feeding organism that's happily trying to kill my plant. So my soil is no longer soil. This is dirt. We've got a disease-causing fungi attacking our root system, and that means we don't have the defense. We have lost the good set of organisms protecting that root. That root, that plant, no longer has the nutrients to maintain suppressive conditions. This is an unhealthy, stressed plant, and the disease-causing organisms are letting you know. This is a message from Mother Nature. Start reading the book. She's telling you. You don't have the right biology in the soil, get it back in there. Or, roots, plant's going to die. Ooh, what's this organism? Single-celled organism. Aren't those cute little hairs on it? It's a cute organism, isn't it? Because this thing is mobile. It's using those little hairs to go zooming around. It actually takes a walk on the root system like this. But when you realize what this is, your heart drops into your shoes. Because this is a bad guy. This is telling you that your soil isn't soil. This is dirt. It's gone anaerobic. Ciliates are protozoa, but they only win in competition with the flagellates and the amoebae when your soil goes anaerobic, when it drops into reduced oxygen conditions. If you take a little bit of your soil and you see those ciliates, take home message, you're going to have dead plants. So let's get in there and fix this. Let's get oxygen. Let's rebuild structure. Let's rebuild that soil so the beneficial organisms are back and we will be able to grow our plants without disease, without the weeds, without the problem organisms. So learning what these different organisms look like. What are we looking at here? Ooh, fun stuff. Yeah, we got some good humic acids. We've got some good aggregates. And so you can see all the little bacteria. How would you like to count all the bacteria in this picture? So we're not going to count the bacteria in this picture. We're going to dilute our sample out until we get a good countable number of bacteria. But we're going to be looking at the fungal hypha. And look at where in this drop of our sample that we're looking at, some of that fungal hypha is out of focus. But a lot of it's in focus. Fungi have to be uniform diameter all along the length of the fungal hypha. So there we are, uniform diameter. The branch doesn't have to be the same diameter, but the branch, the strand, has to be uniform diameter all along that strand. Look at the color. Color tells us that this is probably, almost without doubt, a beneficial fungus. This is going to be competing with all our disease-causing fungi. So, and you can you find any more fungal hyphae in this picture? Did you find this guy right here? Clear, colorless. Ooh, that's not so good. Clear, colorless hyphae, more likely to be a disease-causing fungus. But look at the diameter. This is actually wider in diameter than this is. So if you were more than 3 micrometers in diameter, it's probably a good guy. So how do I even figure out what the diameter of these fungal hyphae are? Well, Mother Nature very happily sent a way we can figure that out just by looking at the organisms in this picture. Find your smallest bacterium that's in focus. So let's go up in this corner and we can find our little tiny bacteria. That's an individual bacterium, but notice it's larger than that guy. So can we find a smaller? Oh yeah, there's a smaller bacterium right there. Little round cocci. And so if we take that bacterium as our smallest bacterium, that's 1 micrometer in width. So how many of those little bacteria can we line up? It would help if my hand wasn't shaking. No more coffee for me. So 1 bacterium, 2, 3, 4. Will you give me about 4 micrometers in diameter? Way larger than 3 micrometers, so it's got to be a good guy fungus. It's colored. It's got to be a good guy fungus. So this is a disease suppressor. Well, now how about this fungus? How many of those little bacteria can you line up? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is this a good guy fungus? Yeah, because the diameter is telling us that most likely it's a good guy fungus. There aren't any bad guy fungi that have diameters of 6 micrometers. Yeah, it's colorless, so we can start ranking our fungi. How many of you found the fungal hypha right down here? Oh, isn't that sneaky? Over here in the corner. Notice that it's narrower diameter than this, but it is colored. So it's probably a good guy. What is the diameter? So there's 1, 2, 3.5. Is it a good guy? Yeah. It's wider than 3 micrometers, so probably a good guy. Where's the disease-causing fungus in this picture? Can you find him? It's a little out of focus. It's right there. Now, notice that, you know, this is the only part of this fungus that's in focus. You've got to focus along that fungal hypha to determine whether it's uniform diameter. So don't make that mistake. As you focus all the way along that fungal hypha, it's uniform diameter. It's just sitting in your drop of water like this. So the only part that's in focus is right there. But this fungus, you can see where it's colorless, and it's a very narrow diameter. It's about a 2 micrometer diameter. It's colorless. This is Pythium. Now, if I took this sample and I plated it out in a petri dish where we had a medium that only grows Pythium, is the Pythium going to grow? Well, duh. Of course it is. Are any of the good guy fungi going to grow on that medium that only grows Pythium? Yeah, so you see where I can scare you? If I'm doing plate count methods, I can go, oh my gosh, you've got so much Pythium in here, it's just going to destroy all of your plants. You're going to have terrible disease. You've got to get out there right now and put a fungicide out there and shut this problem down right now. Liar, liar, pants on fire. Because we've got all these beneficial fungi in here that will shut that Pythium down. There is not a chance. I have never had that problem where we've got good beneficial fungi and quite a bit of it. We don't have disease problems because we're going to have the nutrient cycling. We're not going to allow that Pythium to be able to grow in the aerobic conditions. Now, in this picture, do we have more bacterial biomass or more fungal biomass in here? Well, by the time you measure the length of all of these hyphae, calculate width, you get the biomass of your fungus, you count all your bacteria and get the biomass of your bacteria, we're actually looking at a fungal-dominated soil. There is more fungal biomass in here than anything else. So our pH is going to be slightly acidic, because more fungi produce more slightly acidic organic acids, and so our pH is going to be sitting somewhere around 6.5 to 6.8. Great for growing shrubs, great for growing trees, perfect for your red clover. Ooh, not so good for your white clover, and really absolutely the wrong thing to grow yellow clover. So these balances of the different organisms are going to start influencing what's going to be growing in my soil. Slightly acidic pHs in our soils mean that the nitrifying bacteria can't function. The enzymes to nitrify only occur when you're in alkaline conditions in the soil. Our nitrifying bacteria may be growing, but they cannot produce the enzymes to convert your NH4 into NO3. So we are setting up a conditions that is perfect for our trees, for our shrubs, for highly productive meadow conditions. If we have more bacterial biomass than fungal biomass, because our bacteria are producing alkaline glues to glue those microaggregates together, that means the pH is going to be above 7. That means our nitrifying bacteria are making the enzymes to convert NH4 into NO3. So the balance of these organisms have consequences for chemistry. Chemistry is a consequence of the biology that you've got, not the other way around. The organisms are determining what's going on in your soil and who's growing more bacteria or more fungi, who's controlling more fungi or more bacteria. It's your plant. Let your plant be in control of its own life. So I'm running out of time. It's 8 o'clock, and we were supposed to do some questions and answers for people. So I just want to quick go through. When we go through succession, bare soil, weeds, what sets the stage to grow weeds? Very bacterial dominated. If you have almost no fungal biomass in your soil and you've got lots of bacteria, you are setting the stage for high pulses of nitrate, which is perfect for your weeds. How many of you have got weed problems? I can tell you exactly what your soil is right now. If what's growing in your soil are weeds, guess what your biology is? Extremely bacterial dominated. As we start to get more fungi into the system, now we're going to be growing your veggies. Now we're going to be growing most of our vegetable garden crops. As we get balanced fungi to bacteria, now we have highly productive pastures, highly productive meadows. Then we're selecting against those weedy species and for these other plants. As we go over the edge into a fungal dominated, more fungi than bacteria, now we're growing shrubs and deciduous trees. As we go into our old growth forests, minimum levels of 7,000 micrograms of fungi. Typically, highly productive, very healthy, 70,000 micrograms of fungal biomass. Who's the largest organism, individual organism on this planet? It's not redwood trees. It's not whales. It's a fungus. The current winner lives in the Olympic Peninsula. So work by Paul Stamets, he goes out and he measures the width of this particular fungus. So right now, the current winner is Paul Stamets' fungus in the Olympic Peninsula. It's 20 miles across. And it goes anywhere from just a couple of inches into the soil down to as deep as 25 feet, at which point we gave up. We figured we had proved that this is the largest organism on the planet. It is the size, it has the biomass of, I think it's 6 blue whales. And it lives here in Washington State. You're in the Guinness Book of World Records! Woohoo! In the springtime, so through the winter under the snow, that fungus grows. It just has a grand old time growing, decomposing, making really good humus. And when that snow melts in the springtime, if you go out into the Olympic Peninsula, you dig down into the soil, all of that soil is just a mass of fungal hyphae. It's so thick, and you try to push your fingers into that soil, try to pick up some of that soil, it's all held together by those fungal strands. But when the microarthropods wake up, come springtime, when the earthworms wake up, come springtime, when all those cute predators in the system wake up, and they're looking at all that wonderful fungal hyphae, they go, wee-ha-nya! And just eat it to bits. So by the time we hit mid-May in the Olympic Peninsula, early June, there's just little tiny islands of that fungus left here and there. And you would think that, oh no, there's not much fungus in this forest. Yeah, because it just got eaten. Think of the nutrient cycling. How did all those old growth trees get the nutrients that they require to be able to grow and put on another year's worth of growth? Sequestering nutrients, holding nutrients, mostly carbon, in that wood. So all summer long, the microarthropods are having a good old time, but it starts getting dry. Those microarthropods start going to sleep. All of our predators start getting ready for winter. And now here come the fall rains, here comes snow. And now the fungus recovers. And all that plant litter material that fell to the surface of the soil underneath the snow, that fungus is going, now it's my turn. And now we've got fungal hyphae 20 miles across, single individual. How do you figure that one out? That this is actually the same individual 20 miles across. You do DNA analysis, and it's exactly the same sequence of DNA coming out of all of the samples that we're taking from that individual for the whole volume of that soil. Largest organism on the planet. Guess what? The guys in Finland coming real close. They've been looking because they want the title. Well, Michigan State would like to have, well, so yeah, there's a little competition in the academic world. So will Paul remain the winner of the biggest organism on the planet race? So it's kind of fun. So largest organism on the planet. Yeah, think about 3/4 of the weight of a gram of soil is fungal biomass. It drives me crazy when you talk to an agronomist and they say, oh, we've measured how much microorganisms in the soil. Microorganisms in the soil are only 5% of the weight of a gram of soil. Really? You haven't been looking very well. So let's throw that one back in their face too. If you go into an agricultural soil where we've been using pesticides and we've been using inorganic fertilizers and we've been tilling the living daylights out of that soil, every time you till, guess what you're doing to your fungi? Slice, dice, crush, and destroy. You don't want to till. Then how are you going to get rid of weeds? Well, shift your fungal to bacterial biomass ratio. Get out of this condition. Get that fungus. Move it along in this direction. What are you trying to grow? So get the biology in the soil appropriate for the plant you want to grow. And stop tilling. Pardon? You're going to make compost. And put lots of fungal foods in there. So what are fungal foods? Wide seed-in ratio materials. Plant materials that have a carbon to nitrogen ratio higher than 60 carbons for every nitrogen. If you want to grow more bacteria, you get green plant material. Carbon to nitrogen ratio, 30-1. And so you're going to put into this compost, do I need more fungal foods? Is it fungi that I'm lacking in my soil? So I'm going to put a lot of that woody stuff. I'm going to put paper, cardboard. I'm going to put wood chips. I'm going to put dead leaves that fell off of my trees at this time of year. Because the plant pulled in most of those nutrients stored in their root systems. So the plant, the leaf material, seed-in ratio on those dead leaves, 150 to 200 carbons for every one nitrogen. Fungal food. There is not a bacterium on this planet that can use those dead leaves as a food resource. So wide seed-in ratio material. Straw. Anything that was cut once it went dormant. Coffee grounds are actually green stuff. Yeah, because coffee is picked green. Just because we roasted it didn't turn it into fungal food. So really good bacterial food. And your worms adore that when you put that into your worm bins. They absolutely have a grand old time. So what are the starting materials? So invite me back so we can have a compost day and go through everything in the detail that we need to have. So as we change the biology, we shift from strictly nitrate to balanced nitrate and ammonium to ammonium. You should not have any nitrate in a forest soil. Nitrate causes disease in all of our trees. There have been 2 books that have been written about this. Nitrate is a huge no-no when you're trying to grow orchard trees. Do not put nitrate fertilizers out unless you really want diseased trees. So don't enhance the diseases in the system. So when we go through succession, you know, just another way of expressing that where I'm actually putting in the fungal to bacterial biomass ratios. I'd love to have time to go through this, but sorry. What causes us to go backwards in succession? It's called disturbance. You go in and till your soil, and you're going backwards in succession. How far back are you going when you till your soil? How far backwards are you going when a flood comes along and you go anaerobic because all the oxygen gets used up in your soil? It depends on the biology. So how far backwards? Or did we go back to there? Or did we go back to there? Yellowstone National Park, in the last big fire in Yellowstone about 30 years ago, maybe more like 32 years ago, there were parts of Yellowstone where a real light fire just ran over the surface, and all that happened was the trees grew better the next year. Didn't destroy the soil at all. There were places where the trees burned, and it burned down into the soil, but ended up with an equal biomass of fungi to bacteria afterwards and some of the most amazing meadows. We found plants, flowering species in Yellowstone Park that we had never seen there before because now finally they'd been released from the dormancy underneath those trees. There were places where it burned so hot for so long it melted the silica in the soil and it turned the soil surface into glass. So we went all the way back. About 3 years ago, I was invited to come back to Yellowstone National Park and look at the biology in these soils. And for the first time, all of those places had recovered. So this was 29 years after that fire, before everything started to recover. So how intense is the disturbance? How much of the biology did we destroy? And if you somehow get back in here, you got to get the fungi back in the soil. You got to get that compost out there. So we start moving things along to, what kind of plant do you want to grow? So strawberries. What is the fungal to bacterial biomass ratios that strawberries require? Well, think about where strawberries are found out in the natural ecosystem. Are they found in meadows? Are they found in shrublands? Are they found in forests? They're understory plants in forests. So now, what is the proper fungal to bacterial biomass ratio for you to be able to grow strawberries without weeds, without pests, without insect and disease problems? Well, you got to be right there. We need 5 times more fungi than bacteria, up to 100 times more fungi than bacteria, depending on the strawberry cultivar that you want to grow. But if you want to be weed-free and you want to be disease-free and you want fantastic flavored strawberries, that's what you need. So in California, we go out and we methylbromide the soil. When you methylbromide your soil, where are you putting that fungal to bacterial biomass ratio? Yeah, we're right back here. So why do we have problems? Why do we have diseases? Why do we have pests? Why do we have weeds in those systems? Well, duh. What have you set the stage to grow? So anybody have a plant species that they'd like to know what that fungal to bacterial biomass ratio is? Grapes? So think about where in succession grapes are normally coming into the system. So we've got to go through, not weed systems. We've got to develop the meadows, the grasses. We've got to go over the edge into a fungal-dominated system. And it's here at the edges of the meadows, as we're starting to go into shrubs and they're coming into the system, fungal to bacterial biomass ratio needs to be up there around 2 times more fungi to 5 times more fungi than bacteria. So that's what we want for our grapes. And then we don't have understory weeds. You don't like the weeds? You don't like mowing all those weeds? Because, boy, that's a pain in the butt. Let's make sure that we're putting in some understory species so that we're maintaining this proper fungal to bacterial biomass ratio. Low-growing, short, 1 to 3 inch tall plants. Go to my website. I've got a list of what those plants would be for this part of the world. Pick your favorite ones. Now, come next spring, which of the short understory plant species are going to grow next spring? Well, which one of us knows what the weather's going to be like next April? We don't know. So we got to hedge our bets. Let's put in a mix of 25 different species of low-growing, short plants that are going to protect your soil surface from compaction. What's the most compacting element that we have in all of our ecosystems? What's the most likely thing to cause compaction that human beings don't do? Rainfall. Compacts your soil probably worse than anything else other than tillage. So we don't want bare soil. Never bare soil. So let's put in the plant species that are not going to interfere with whatever it is you want to grow. So grapes. Let's make sure you don't ever have to mow under your grapes again. Plant those short, low-growing, but perennial plants. And we're going to put in a mixture of 25 species. So come next spring, 3 or 4 of those species are going to take off and grow, maybe slightly different ones in this part of the field as opposed to elsewhere in the field. Next year, it's going to be a different set of those plants that come up. But they're going to protect your soil. Their roots are going to grow deep down into the soil, and they're going to maintain the structure. They're going to contain the nutrient cycling. And, oh, yeah, they share mycorrhizal fungi with your grapes. Oh, but if you have understory plants, it's going to be taking water away from your desired crop. Excuse me? Anyone got data on that? And they don't. When you talk to chemical companies, they'll always say, oh, back in the 1940s, we did that research and we proved that if you have any kind of plants growing underneath your trees or your shrubs or your grapevines, it's going to take water away. It's going to take nutrients away. Excuse me? How could we ever have a nutrient deficiency? Until you run out of rocks and sand and silt and clay and organic matter in your soil, there will be no nutrient deficiency as long as you're maintaining that food web. So exit that one from your mind right now. Will these understory plants take water away from our overstory plant? No, they're a building structure. We're going to keep all of that snow melt. It's going to be stored in your soil. How far down are the roots of your grapes going to have to go to get to that summer water? Well, how far down can the roots of your grapevines grow? Go take a trip to France. Go take a trip to Italy. And go to some of the oldest vineyards on this planet that we know about. So I work with a number of the vineyards in Italy where they have documentation that they have grapevines that are 450 years old. Haven't replanted them in that whole entire, and some of their wine is the most expensive wine on the planet. I've never gotten a bottle out of them. Well, you know, it's $1,000 a bottle. So I can't afford that. But someday, how far down into the soil do the root systems of those grapevines go? Go into the caverns below, the limestone caves underneath those vineyards. 60 feet down in the soil, and you get down to that level, and you start walking along, and you have to push the roots of the grapevine aside in order to be able to walk through those hallways. How far down do the roots of grapes go? 3-4 feet? Who does not understand how plants are supposed to grow? So when we're looking at these sorts of things, actually I have some pictures in here. You know, compaction. Look at what compaction does to your soil. Yeah, there's where your roots are. Yeah, because we till to that level and we impose the compaction. When you're using tillage equipment, it presses down on your soil at the depth at that time that the blade goes. And so you're compacting. Yeah, you fluffed this soil. Yeah, there we go. We fluffed that soil when it got tilled, but we compacted the soil there. So now the roots of your plants can't grow down any deeper than that because it's anaerobic. They won't grow deeper than that. So how do you fix this problem? You got to get the biology back into the soil. And maybe when the compaction is this bad, the compaction here is 600 pounds per square inch. If you push on that soil, if you're pushing 600 PSI, you still can't get a metal rod through that soil. So how are you going to fix this problem? Yeah, okay, you're going to till the last time and till your compost as deep as you possibly can. And then you plant your seeds up here. But by the time the root system of that wheat grows down there to 4 feet, we are going to hope the bacteria and fungi have started the job of building structure so the roots of your wheat plants can go down the 10 feet that they ought to be going in the first growing season. You have to irrigate your property? Do you have to irrigate your wheat? Do you have to worry about water if the root systems of your plant is going down that deep? So when you're going into your soil with a metal rod, take a penetrometer, metal rod where it's got a pressure gauge on top. You know, where do you find the place where you can't push that metal rod? You know, you take the old sledgehammer, bam, and you still can't push it into the soil. There's your compaction layer you got to deal with. So you may, one last time, till your soil and till your compost deeper than that. Break up that compaction layer. Yep, because you just imposed the compaction layer where you tilled. But we now put the biology in there. And because it's not a compaction layer that's been sitting around for years and years and years, you don't have the salt buildup. So those microorganisms can very rapidly rebuild the structure at that depth. Because you've put in compost. You've put in the organic matter to help feed them. And so they're going to be growing on that organic matter. And then hopefully whatever crop we put in there, that root system is going to get down to that level quite rapidly and start feeding our microorganisms with the exudates coming out of the root system. Now, does it work every time? Well, you know, you got to be checking. You know, how far down are the roots of your grasses going? Get that penetrometer out. Get it, make sure that it's going all the way. I love to do that to people. You know, get out there and let's check your penetrometer. How long does it take? Even if you put your microorganisms, the compost, just on the surface, how far down are those organisms rebuilding structure? Penetrometer. Get that metal rod with the pressure gauge. It costs all of what? $10 to build a penetrometer? Pressure gauge from the hardware store? Metal rod? Push on the pressure gauge. So making sure that the bottom plate is where your metal rod, and just push and look and see how much pressure you've got to apply to push that metal rod into the soil. And when it gets over 150 PSI, your root systems are not going to go deeper than that. Work at Penn State has very clearly shown 150 PSI, most of the roots of most of our plants cannot push their way through that soil. Tap-rooted plants can push their way through soil up to 300 PSI. Over 300 PSI, there is not a plant on the planet, apparently, that can push its way through that. Yeah, so you've got to get rid of the compaction. It sounds like you've already done that by getting really good biology into your soil and you're building some good structure. As long as you're not destroying the life by doing a little bit of tillage, especially if you're like deep digging or something, you're not really breaking up all of the structure. You're just turning shovelfuls. You don't really kill all the life in there. So, you know, look at the difference between a moldboard plow. Moldboard plow takes your soil and just flips it. And most of the biology isn't even really harmed in that just turned soil. Yeah, but now you come in with a chisel plow, oh, a lot more damaging. But it doesn't kill everything. Come in with some of the disc plows, way more damaging. Come in with a rototiller. Yeah, you might as well as put a sterilant into your soil because you just wiped out like everyone except the bacteria. And so when you've killed everything except the bacteria, now what are you going to grow? Woohoo! So let's not do that. So be gentle. If you're going to till, be gentle. And as you're tilling, put more compost in there. Replenish the biology that you might be killing. So you went in and you tilled and you forgot to put any compost in there. Well, then take your compost and make an extract out of it and apply the extract into your soil to replenish the biology that you put in there or that you might have destroyed by the tillage problem. So there's always multiple ways to deal with all of this. Now, take a look at this picture. Now, this is why arboriculturalists think that root systems of trees only go down a couple feet and then they go sideways. Where's the compaction? And what caused that compaction in here originally? This comes from the farmer who originally owned this property, sold it to a housing development driving over the soil with their big equipment. By law, you must compact your soil around any foundation. It must be compacted. And now you're going to have to deal with it. So we're going to have to rebuild that structure. So we've got to let that root system grow down as deep as it possibly can. So yes, this tree, it's sick, it's unhealthy, it always has disease, it always has pests, it always has, well, so do these. So how are you going to fix this? This is because of the mechanical compaction of that layer. And then as water moves down through this, water is going to hang up at that interface. And as this puddles and goes totally anaerobic, see the black, dark color all along that layer? Anaerobic. You're losing nutrients. You're making highly toxic materials. The pH of that soil is about 4. Probably what I would do around something like this, I don't want to disturb this soil because I'm going to be killing my tree. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to take an injection system. And so I will probably go around this tree at 4 points, about 2 feet out from the trunk of the tree. And I'm going to inject down past that compaction layer. And I'm going to be putting about a half a gallon of a good compost extract into that soil. And I'm going to be releasing that compost extract all the way up through that column of soil. Then I'm going to do another one here, another one there, another one there. Then I'm going to go halfway between the stem and the drip line of that tree. I'm going to be putting 8 cores in injecting my compost tea. So I start building the structure without destroying the root system of this already existing tree. Then I'm going to go out here to drip line, and I'm going to put 16 cores all the way around this tree. Now, we've done this with oaks in California, where they were being attacked by sudden oak death. And we went out to the drip line. These trees were so huge. We were working on a movie star's property ranch in California, and they wanted this tree to be rescued. This was like the center point of their whole landscape. You must save this tree. So we did essentially that. That tree had a canopy about 50 feet across. And so there were 32 holes that we put in and applied the compost extract, and then went back in a quarter of the way, half of the way, three quarters of the way, and then right around the base of the tree. So massive amount of compost in there. The tree had basically defoliated. It had no leaves left. And so all the arboriculturalists had said, you have to take this tree down. By law, you have to take this tree down. And they went, no. And if you're dealing with movie stars, they can get away with it. So we went out there, and that tree is happy, healthy, and growing today. You can go to their ranch and take a look at it. We've done that. Hendrika Schraven here in up in Seattle is constantly doing that. In Seattle, in Issaquah is where his business is. And so I've worked with Hendrikas for years on this sort of thing. On the East Coast, I work with James Sotillo, the person who designed the pathway, the garden. How many of you know the High Line in New York City? Yep. So he's the person who did that, and it is all being done with compost and compost tea. So. How do you make compost tea? You have to have a tea brewer of some kind. And so typically a cone tank is the easiest thing to get. You want to put a valve at the bottom of your cone tank so you can close it, fill your tank up with water. So think about how much compost tea you're going to need. You typically put compost tea out at about 5 gallons per acre. And I don't care how much water you use to spread that compost tea. If it's good compost tea with good organisms, 5 gallons per acre. If it's not so good sets of organisms in there, 200 gallons per acre. So you got to look at your biology. But so I only need 5 gallons, so it's going to be a small container. You want to start aerating that water so you get rid of any chlorine. If you've got chloramine in the water, you're going to add humic acid to complex the chloramine. We're now going to take a bag of really stiff fabric with good mesh size, so we need at least 400 micrometer opening sizes in that mesh. Your compost goes in there. For a gallon of compost tea, you would typically put in about 1/4 pound of compost, and then you turn the aeration on so you get good extraction of the organisms. And you would then add some food resources. Do you need more bacteria than what you've got in the compost, or do you need more fungi? Fungal foods. So fungal foods would be things like humic acid. It would be fish hydrolysate, kelp, fungal foods. Most of us don't need to be adding more bacteria into our soil. That is not the problem that we have. So fungal foods go into your compost tea. And so you let that brew. At 70 degrees, you would let that brew for 24 hours. If you were brewing at this temperature, where we're, you know, down in the, you know, 55, maybe 60 degrees, you would be brewing for 48 hours. So you're going to brew somewhere around 18 hours to 48 hours, depending on the temperature. Organisms grow slower when it's cooler. And then when you're done brewing, all of that good food that you put in there has been used up. You've grown massive quantities of your fungi, your protozoa. Hopefully your nematodes were in the compost, so you've extracted all of them. They're in your compost tea, and now you're going to go out and spray that compost tea on your foliage. Tea goes on foliage. Extract goes into the ground. What's the difference between extract and tea? I have a suspicion that question was going to come. Should be the same concentration of organisms. So invariably with a compost extract, you're going to use more compost because we're not growing anything. So if we're going to make a gallon of compost extract instead of 1/4 pound of compost to be making that gallon of extract, as opposed to the tea. We use 1/4 pound for our tea in 1 gallon. We're typically going to be using 10 times more. So what would that be? 1/4 gallon times 10, or 1/4 pound times 10. I can't do the math when I'm standing in front of people. So that's how much goes in there to start with. You massage that compost briskly for about 30 seconds. And there you go, compost extract. 30 seconds. Think you can manage that? That's why I like extract way more than compost tea. Compost tea is a pain. But if you're going onto your foliage, you've got a foliar fungal disease, you've got foliar insects, you've got scale, you've got blight on your apple trees, you've got, you know, apple scab or any of that, first application of the compost tea to deal with those is typically at bud swell. And then about a month later, second application, a month later for your third application, and then you kind of have to look at your plant and decide whether you need a fourth application. But my apple trees never have apple scab. I don't have scale. I got one tree that has a little bit of blight on it. 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 Blight on it.